You're with Brian McClain and Timothy Shea and State of the Nation on today's News Talk TNT.
This is State of the Nation live on today's News Talk. TNTRadio.live is our website. Hello in the interactive live chat room. Thank you for joining Timothy Shea and I. We're very pleased to have you with us for this live broadcast at today's News Talk. Now, exactly 51 days ago on this program, I noted the 31st anniversary of the beginning of the siege of the Branch Davidians. Well, it is now April 19th, and we can now also mark the 31st anniversary of all the people that lost their lives in that incident 31 years ago, just not very many miles north from where I broadcast right now. The FBI launched a tear gas attack in an attempt to force the Branch Davidians out of the compound's building. Shortly thereafter, the Mount Carmel Center became engulfed in flames. The fire and the reaction to the final attack within the group resulted in the deaths of 76 Branch Davidians, including 25 children and David Koresh. So in total, that 51-day siege, and if you've been watching this show for the last 51 days, think about that. You probably remember when I came in and noted that the entire time marked from then until now, that 51-day span, those people were pretty much tortured in that building by the FBI and the ATF, who also lost members unnecessarily in this. So again, in total, the 51-day siege resulted in the deaths of 4 federal agents, 82 Branch Davidians, 28 of whom were children. So that's a terrible moment in U.S. history right there, and a moment that I would say we probably should have pumped the brakes and had a big discussion about the powers of the DOJ, the FBI, and the ATF. Weaponization is not new, Timothy.
It is not new, and today was not chosen at random for that final assault on the Branch Davidian compound, just as it was not chosen at random by Representative Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District for his leaving Congress. If he'd left on Monday, they could have had a special election to replace him. But no, Mike sees himself as some sort of patriot for giving Congress to the Democrats to keep Donald Trump out of office, I guess, because today is the 249th anniversary of the Battle of Lexington and Concord. And one of the nicest traditions in Massachusetts, they celebrated Patriots Day last Monday, but what they do is you all get together, you got to start lining up at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, because they do a timeline correct historical reenactment, not only of the Battle of Lexington on Lexington Green. You see the redcoats coming marching up the street and the militia being called out, and everything is authentic and on the same clock is the events of that day. And then they march off and they reenact the battle at the Old North Bridge in Concord. But that's why FBI and ATF chose today as the final assault, because Brian, in some misguided fashion, they saw themselves as patriots for doing so. And when you think yourself a patriot for attacking the citizens of this country, I don't care what their beliefs are, there's something rotten in Denmark.
Yeah. And much like a number of the arrests that we've seen, politicized arrests, you know, SWAT-oriented arrests that we've seen, even ATF raids recently where they tamper with evidence before they come to the house and put tape over the Ring cameras, you know. Yeah. These are the kind of things that could be easily avoided, absolutely easily avoided, you know. And then there's an entrapment factor also that happens within the story of the Branch Davidians and many of the other situations that we've had, like, you know, Sugar Pine Mine and Ruby Ridge, another classic example where people have been stitched up and then raided when the federal government and federal law enforcement agencies had every opportunity to pick these people up in a nonviolent fashion. Yep. They've decided to make media spectacles out of it, and now they have Netflix to try to enshrine those horrors in the modern time, and totally disregard and leave out the stories of those many of those that were on the inside. So
yeah, and I think you'll agree with me. that the branch COVIDians were a lot greater threat to this country and inflicted far more far greater harm to our nation than the branch Davidians ever did.
150%. Hey, for all the latest community events, rallies, marches, festivals, and fundraisers happening near you, then visit our What's On Events calendar on the TNT website at tntradio.live and stay in touch on today's News Talk TNT.
Keeping the commitment.
I love you guys.
Unbelievable.
24/7.
Listen to you every day, have for years.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, we're about to be joined by our colleague Patrick Henningsen, independent journalist and geopolitical analyst, founder of 21stCenturyWire.com, host of the Patrick Henningsen Show right here on Today's News Talk, and of course, host of Sunday Wire at 21Wire on X.com and 21stCenturyWire.com. Patrick, welcome to State of the Nation. Great to see you today. What's breaking?
Well, I thought you were going to tell me what's breaking up. I'm here available for commentary and analysis. Hello, right. Brian and Tim. How are you guys doing? I hope it's a good day in the state of the nation. I hope it's a good day in the state of the nation.
It's a bit of a dumpster fire sometimes, but we're always doing our best to have a good time here, Patrick. So the thing that I'm curious about is what went down last night after Timothy and I turned our microphones off. We started seeing reports of, you know, some sort of strike happening in Iran. Then some of these things were pulled back, and it's been very confusing. I was watching your show today. Even your guests are kind of still trying to figure out what's gone on. So from your perspective, what happened last night in Iran?
Well, the short answer is nobody knows for sure. There's a lot of unofficial denials and non-confirmations. So I'll tell you what we do know. What we do know is a lot of the early reporting was exaggerated. So the headlines, if you looked at U.S. media, was Israel strikes Iran. Okay, so a lot of people took that at face value. I went and checked, see what CNN, Al Jazeera, maybe some more, you know, Middle Eastern type mainstream media outlets, see what they're saying. Nothing at all the first 2 hours. Fox got on it after 2 hours, and ABC sort of got on it. And it was all a bit murky. It was a bit strange. And then we started saying, oh, there's nuclear facilities in Isfahan. That's the heartland of Iran. And that Israel has struck there with missiles. There were reports about U.S. air refueling over Iraqi airspace. There was a whole picture that was painted. A whole story was being constructed. And meanwhile, I was just sitting back, and you know how we are, Hesher. Wait for confirmation. Wait for the receipts. Receipts weren't coming in. And so I was looking at the source of this. U.S. sources tell this media outlet, British sources tell U.S. sources who told a media outlet. I didn't hear anything from Israel, nothing from Israel. Iran finally reports there's been some explosions near the airport in Isfahan. The nuclear facility is about 60, 70 miles away, so no danger of those being struck. And so air explosions, that's what it ended up being. So we have two reports right now. The prevailing report is four small quadcopters. These are drones, not very big, triggered Iranian air defenses in Isfahan. The other report coming from one or two Middle Eastern journalists is that there were missiles that were fired from Israel, three of them intercepted by Israeli air defenses. And so it looks like it's in the quadcopter story or drones internal. So could have been hacked, commandeered, launched internally. They have opposition extremist MEK cells in Iran. It's a big country, 100 million people, massive country. It's about 80 times the size of Israel, just to give you a little bit of, or what size of Western Europe, basically. So it's a big country. And so it was a big nothing burger, actually, at the end of the day. So Iran doesn't seem to think this requires or warrants response. They promised a response to Israel. Israel has no official position at all on what happened. The United States, all a bit sort of murky. So we don't have anything new on the escalation ladder. I think that's the main point, especially after last Friday, November 14th. That was certainly something of a spectacle last Friday when Iran struck Israel, and then all the interceptions and everything, and then the political fallout from that. Israel vowed to retaliate, but no significant retaliation so far. So that's where we're at.
All right. And we're hearing, you know, reports that if it was quadcopters, they could have come from within Iran somewhere, or like, I don't know, elsewhere, perhaps. Anything else on the, you know, maybe the origin of these things?
It looks up for that size of a drone, if indeed is the case. I have nothing to support the missile report, the three missiles, but if it's quadcopters, it would have to be local. It'd have to be internal. Too far, I think, for Azerbaijan, too far for Balochistan. So these are sort of, you know, semi-unfriendly, potential areas there. So definitely not from Israel, definitely not. So, you know, who knows? I mean, it's all a bit sketchy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we had a veto by the United States this week at the United Nations Security Council. Any updates on that? Anything of note you want to report on that one?
No, not just that it's, you know, a U.S. veto. It's nothing new at the U.N. Security Council. I think they've had a whole string of vetoes about various issues relating to Palestine, to Gaza, for instance. I will say, though, yeah, I can't see the U.S. voting for statehood. That would just incense their friends in Tel Aviv to a level that I think would potentially erupt maybe into a shouting match internationally. Nobody wants that. So, but I will say Israel has quite a lot of leverage this week over the United States, because they could, of course, as they declared, they want to retaliate. U.S. said, we're not going to assist you in any retaliation against Iran. Ergo, Israel showing restraint is a type of a bargaining chip with Washington. So there's a number of quid pro quos there. One of them, of course, would be Israel could say to the U.S., you better vote no or veto that state recognition resolution at the U.N. Security Council. The other one is the building of settlements in Gaza. It was announced by Netanyahu last week. Would the U.S. accept that? Previously, they've said they wouldn't, but they didn't seem to object. So that could have been on the table as well. So there's a number of things that Israel can use as a bargaining chip. So they do have quite a lot of leverage over, not to mention the funding bill, by the way. That's not nothing. If 20, 30 billion. I don't know what Israel's share of that is, latest count, but that's something as well. So I think they did pretty well in terms of they got everything they wanted this week. Israel did. But they didn't retaliate against the Iranians as they said they would. The United States is, I think, restraining them for sure on that. I don't think the U.S. wants to be pulled into any kind of a confrontation with Iran for obvious reasons. So they are acting as a sort of check on Tel Aviv. So, yeah, there's a lot of maneuvering going on there. So, yeah, interesting.
Yeah. It looks like $26.3 billion to Israel and $60.84 billion to Ukraine. And what is this? $13.8 billion on top, I think. I think that goes to Ukraine also for U.S. weapons purchases directly. And then another $3.9 billion in direct military aid in the Indo-Pacific there. So that one is, it seems like... up on Capitol Hill, they're working on a lot today. They're trying to get that one through. They're also looking at, what they're calling the TikTok ban bill. I forget the actual acronym, ARPA-ICC or something like that. What do you think about that one? That's some pretty big action going on today. Looking to spend a lot of American money.
It's kind of incredible. I mean, Speaker Mike Johnson, he said he's prepared to lose his job, because he really believes this is the right thing to do. So, you know, good on you, Mike. Good luck with that. I honestly don't see the problem, the difference between Kevin McCarthy and Mike Johnson at this point, other than Mike Johnson's not wearing a Ukrainian handkerchief in his front pocket of his blazer. It doesn't have the lapel pin, but I mean, I can't. But this is where we're at right now with this whole thing. So, it's not what Matt Gaetz envisioned when they sort of motioned to vacate. Remember that great scene in Congress. So here we are. This kind of shows you the power of the permanent state in an election year. There's not a lot of daylight, unfortunately, in terms of this funding issue between the Biden and Trump administration. So that's certainly something that's I don't think is good for voters. I think there needs to be more daylight there so people can make maybe some contrast, maybe make a real choice there. Just a little hint to the Republican Party. It's like in a great position. I mean, this is like the door's already open. You just have to push. But that's not what's happening.
I think
happening.
What we're seeing, Mike never wanted the job. I think what we're seeing is Mike Johnson has figured out a way for him to no longer be speaker because he never wanted the job. And it's been obvious.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's one thing. I mean, I think it's pretty accepted now. Mainstream press is already writing obituaries for Ukraine. So, I mean, this is we're migrating now into a new phase there. They'll still support it. But there's going to be a negotiated settlement at some point. Probably they'd want to kick that can down after the election, down the road till after November. I'm sure nobody wants to own the reckoning of, oh my God, why did we waste all this money, time, and human life in Ukraine? So nobody wants to own that. That'll happen in 2025, as far as the U.S. is concerned. But the Israeli-Iran thing, to me, is extraordinary because this is the first time that any country has attacked Israel directly since really going back to the Arab Israeli wars in 68 and also in 73 with the Yom Kippur War. So Iran actually threatened and actually did it. And that's a game changer for the United States because if you look at what happened, Iran and the U.S. had direct communication. Iran told them what targets were hitting. They did deconfliction checks to make sure that no U.S. facilities will be touched. All of that stuff was checked in advance. They made the public warning. So this is kind of unusual. This is not something that I've expected to see, is that the United States is basically open that line of communication via the Swiss envoy in Tehran. That's their, you know, that's their go-between in Iran, is the Swiss embassy and their diplomatic team. So that means that the U.S. has recognized Iran as a regional superpower because they're talking first and then U.S. then talks to Israel. So the hierarchy has changed. And this is how the U.S. interfaced with Russia in Syria, and it's also how they would probably interface with China if they got into a three-way scuffle. So, I mean, that's a game changer. And the fact that Israel hasn't responded yet, that totally violates the Israeli doctrine of the last 40 years, which is rise and strike first. You kill one of ours, we'll kill 10 of yours. You hit us with one punch, we'll hit you with 10. The return hit hasn't come. So I think there is a new Middle East that is taking shape. And I think we're going to watch very closely to see how this unfolds over the coming months. It's going to be very interesting.
Yeah, the unfolding is going to be very interesting. All right, Patrick, we're out of time. Be sure and check out the Patrick Henningsen Show right here at Today's News Talk. TNTRadio.live is our website. You can find all archives of all shows for all hosts and all our email addresses, all that good stuff. So we'll see you in the interactive live chat room, on the Patrick Henningsen Show, and right here on State of the Nation. Thanks, Patrick. This is Today's News Talk, TNT.
TNT's Jason Burmess.
Now, whether you like Donald Trump or you think he's literally Hitler, have we ever been in a situation where a person who has led this country could not take a day off from what is obviously a show trial in every respect, way, shape, and form to go see their kid graduate high school? Oh, Jason, he's a billionaire. He doesn't care. That's his like fifth kid. Who cares? How dare you, Jason? He's already got Don Jr. and Eric. He got to go to those. Look, the bottom line is this is grotesque on every level, and it shows how lawfare is being waged against anyone who goes against the narrative, even the President of the United States. And this is very dangerous.
Jason Burmess on Today's News Talk, TNT.
In a democracy, the majority vote rules. But in most democracies, you can only vote for change every 3 or 4 years. To understand what people want, governments and political parties use focus groups. These focus groups can include as little as 20 people. Australia is a country of over 25 million people. Does making decisions based on 20 people sound fair to you? Have your say. Be heard in between elections. Download the For My Say app now. That is number 4, My Say.
Today's News Talk Radio.
I do a lot of streaming radio.
I do a lot of free streaming.
TNTRadio.live.
Scott H. Silverman has been fighting the good fight against addiction for over 20 years. One person, one speech, and one book at a time. He's been recognized by CNN as a hero for his work educating people and spreading awareness and compassion about this scourge. His book, The Opioid Epidemic, What You Don't Know Will Destroy Your Family and Your Life, is available on Amazon. You can follow him on X at Scott H. Silverman and reach out to him on his website if you need help. It's yourcrisiscoach.com. I'd like to welcome back to State of the Nation, Scott Silverman.
Hey, guys. Nice to be here.
Good to see you,
Scott. Last time we talked, we ran out of time because there's so much to talk about. But one of the points that you made that I think bears some further investigation is how the opioid epidemic recognizes no class differences, no economic differences, no racial differences. We're all human beings. We all have a pleasure center buried deep within our brain, and we're all susceptible to this. What can people do to keep their children away from the scourge of drugs, to avoid the pitfalls themselves? And why don't you tell us first how easy it is for people to fall into the trap? Because I've heard some stories, it just astounds me. And I'm a neurobiologist by training, and it's just amazing to me how quickly people can develop problems with addiction.
Well, there's two thoughts, and it's a great question. First of all, there are a certain percentage of our population that are predisposed to having addiction, just like there's a certain percentage that may have diabetes or have cancer or heart disease or, you know, weak muscles or, you know, small brains or small attention spans, things of that nature. And that's organic, and they can't do a whole lot about that. But when it comes to the concept of one pill can kill with this opioid, you know, problem that we have, and the morbidity rate, the death rate continuing to grow, people can make an informed decision and simply not put something in their body that they don't know where it came from. I mean, you know, Trader Joe's, when they get a bad batch of some food, they send out a myriad of emails telling people, bring it back. We just found out from the, you know, distribution center, from the assembly factory or the grower, this is bad, don't eat it. And they're, you know, right now, we're in 90% of the illicit drugs that people are consuming are laced with some level of fentanyl. And that means you could be at a friend's house doing what you do every week, and all of a sudden they share with you, hey, I got a new batch of these pills that'll help you sleep better. Well, they're laced with fentanyl, which, you know, is a synthetic opioid. It's a poison. And if you get it in your body, you could die. So it's that easy to not put it in your system. But you have to be mindful, and you have to make a conscious, common sense decision. I'm not putting this in my body until I know what it is. And there are actual test strips now for fentanyl and for other opioids that you can actually, and there are people who are methamphetamine addicts who don't want to die using drugs. There was a big article here in our community last year, and they actually test their methamphetamine before they put it in their body because they want to get high. They don't want to die.
I remember that being a thing back in the raver days of the mid and late 90s in California. We had a pretty awesome underground raving scene that young people of all ages, frankly, enjoyed. And there was a lot of MDMA usage there. A lot of people went, you know, looking for and a good time, dance, do the Molly, whatever, and you know, go about their lives and call it a weekend. But then there started to become some deaths, and it started to become apparent that there were botched synthesis, I don't know what the plural is on synthesis, but botched synthesis was taking place in the drug making of some sort, or people were putting, you know, PCP in it at you know, doses that were fatal sometimes. So people started having to get those test strips for their MDMA at the rave joints. So it became kind of a really important thing. And then that culture kind of disappeared a little bit. That drug, of course, still popular. But, and I think that a lot of people that take that, you know, these days are probably, you know, already wise enough. Hopefully, if, you know, they're old enough and wise enough, they're not doing it anymore, or maybe lessons learned from before. But I'm glad you're here telling us that this is a thing, because we can't just be giving people Narcan. I've always been just blown away. It's like, oh, we've got a Narcan dispenser over here, but not a single PSA to be seen, not a single DEA raid happening on, you know, the servers at Instagram and Snapchat, where a lot of this stuff is being bought and sold. We don't see anything like that. Just some Narcan, you know, like the very last possible Band-Aid you could possibly need. I'll take your response on this after a brief headline. We'll be right back. This is State of the Nation on today's News Talk. Stay tuned. This is TNT.
Question. Huh? What are you guys doing today?
The news.
Now, TNT Radio News.
Sounds good.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. In the U.S. Senate, ongoing disputes over Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, prompted urgent discussions to renew the program before its deadline today. Minutes after the jury selection concluded in former President Donald Trump's trial in Manhattan, a man set himself on fire across from the courthouse. Planned Parenthood, as the largest abortion provider in the United States, conducted 392,715 abortions during the 2022-2023 period.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
Scott, let's do our own little PSA right here. Take us a little further down this test strip idea. Maybe someone out there knows a raver, or someone who, you know, is not wise in doing these things, but we can give them something to maybe help protect themselves.
You know, you were mentioning Narcan. You know, naloxone is the medication in Narcan. Narcan's the dispensing mode. And what's interesting about Narcan, Narcan's kind of like a fire extinguisher. And, you know, when you hang a fire extinguisher, if you don't need it for 6 or 7 years, hopefully you remember where it is when there's a fire. So, and, you know, there are people that kind of poo-poo the Narcan idea, because people who are addicted to opioids are now using their own Narcan when they go out as a group to help save each other's lives. Because most people, when they take a drug, their mission isn't to kill themselves, unless they're looking to kill themselves. Because OxyContin, you know, which was the big opioid that everybody was taking, we weren't seeing the kind of overdoses that we're seeing now. And fentanyl, again, a synthetic opioid, is in everything that people are taking in the drug world, you know, from methamphetamine to crack cocaine to vaping pipes to being laced in marijuana. And that's the problem with it. And there are rumors now that the cartel, you know, because they're so wealthy off of the sales to our population, are coming out with a new drug that's even stronger than fentanyl. And when people get fentanyl laced in their drugs, the odds are if 8 people take it, 3 or 4 are going to overdose and die. It's just going to happen that way. And there is no quality control. You know, back in my day, when we were getting drugs, in many cases, they were pure drugs. But the purity that we get access to wasn't contaminated with a poison. And like you said, back in the 90s and 2000, people were partying all the time with heroin. They weren't overdosing. But we're seeing it now in a way that's really unusual. And the demographic of the consumer who's overdosing is getting younger and younger. So they're the ones who's, you know, they call them pill parties, you know, or Skittles. Certain time of the night, everybody goes to a bowl, grabs a pill, and hopefully it's not one laced with fentanyl. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but I do know that, you know, there are things out there that we could be doing. Heightened awareness, concept of one pill can kill. What can a parent do? Sit down and talk to their kids. I mean, would you suggest a child not wear a seatbelt in a car? Would you tell your child to drive 90 miles an hour without putting their headlights on in the car? But you don't want to point a finger at somebody, that finger of shame, and make them feel bad. Encourage them to have a conversation with you and just be smart. You know, when my girls grew up, we talked about picking up someone else's drink in a bar, not knowing what might be in it. So that's just good common sense. But if you're not talking about it, there's no awareness around it, and the episode could happen, and you don't get to reverse that. Once you've got that in your system, if your body is predisposed to potentially be sensitive to a synthetic opioid, an overdose, and most times you can't get to the hospital quick enough, and Narcan right now isn't even working as well as it did when it was first distributed because the potency of the fentanyl is so high. And you're right, knuckleheads are making it in their garage, buying it on the dark web. Then there's no quality control there. There is no person who really cares. They just want to sell a drug and make money.
Yeah, there's no quality control whatsoever. And there's a downside that kind of gets hidden. It gets short shrift. And that's people like me that deal with chronic pain. I was in a near-fatal car accident 12 years ago, and I can no longer get the prescription for OxyContin that I need. And the doctor apologized to me, and they said, we're not permitted. We've got to go through so many hoops and so much paperwork in order to write a script for Oxy now. We just can't do it. And so I'm left with the choice of either going out on the street and getting something, which I don't do, or deal with the pain, which is what I do. There's even a man who had to get enough Oxy because his pain was so chronic because his insurance company wouldn't provide him with the pump that kept a constant level in his system. The DEA arrested him as a trafficker. They said there's no way possible this amount of opioid could be for personal consumption. They throw him in prison. And because he's now in prison and the state is paying for it, guess what they gave him? That's right, the pump. So this is how insane our drug policies have become.
I don't disagree with you. And I feel bad that there are a lot of people that need it for legitimate reasons. I mean, fentanyl was originally created to give people who had cancer a higher dosage of something that could help with the pain because morphine wasn't working.
And it's still used by anesthesiologists for surgery.
Correct. And they said this would never leave the hospital. It'd always be IV injected. So that changed. And what happens is you're right. There doesn't seem to be a balance out there. And that's how medical marijuana kind of grew and created its customer base. And now marijuana is so potent and people can buy it for less on the street than they can from a retail licensed distributor. So we don't really have a common sense way of looking at this. And because of the stigma around addiction, people are afraid to have the conversations. I mean, the fact that you even admit that you took medication to make yourself feel better so you wouldn't be in pain is what somebody should be able to get, is something to help prevent that kind of pain. There are some things you can do that are differently. The problem is right now with opioids, everyone's either suggesting yoga, as we've talked about, or marijuana. And neither one of them will really deal with the pain, especially if it's chronic. But pain, as they say, is in the mind. And there are things that, opioids could do to the mind. The problem, even the studies showed over time, OxyContin was really treating pain the right way for any length of time. And then we think about people who are on methadone, the harm reduction, the medication-assisted treatment, who people criticize and say, why would you go from heroin to synthetic heroin? Well, synthetic heroin or methadone keeps people alive. Heroin over time will kill people. So, we do have a lot. It's sad to say at my age, and I've been doing this a lot, we have a long way to go. And I just don't think it's important enough that the conversation's being had, at levels that it should be. Every community's got grassroots groups screaming and yelling. I know they call me and go, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm talking to Brian and Timothy. I mean, I'm doing what I can, but at the end of the day, 90% of the population's not getting the message, and that's a problem.
Yeah. It's a big problem. Yeah,
a big one. And, reading from your Twitter right here, your x.com account, again, Scott H. Silverman, according to the DEA, only 10% of fentanyl that is brought to the border is caught. That means 90% is getting through. And remember, all illegal drugs have fentanyl. And we've seen, of that 10% that they have caught, some of those batches have been big enough to kill everybody in the country twice over.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because criminal justice and even the Border Patrol are doing a, and as an ex drug user. I hate to say this out loud, but they're doing a terrific job. And when they make these large busts, they get tremendous kudos, and they should. But what that means, because the 10% doesn't change. If last year it was 10 tons and this year it's 100 tons, they're still only capturing 10% of it. And since the cartel is just blowing it into this country like a, you know, like a strong wind, there's more out there than ever before. And you can always find it on the dark web. And it's not hard to get whatever you want, whenever you want, wherever you are. So at the end of the day, it's really going to be, it's going to be up to us as human beings to make informed decisions, to talk to each other, to make sure that when we're putting something in our body, you know, and I'm not talking about a hamburger or French fries or pizza. Those are my favorites, and donuts. I'm talking about things that will kill you. Why would you take that risk? Why would you take that risk? And I'm not saying stop partying, because who would I be to, for the years that I did it, to tell someone else not to? And kids are going to experiment. That's a natural path of life. People want to try stuff. They want to experiment it. And when, you know, when these nasty, you know, commercials come out, and you're right, Tim, that we should be having PSAs on a regular basis, and social media should be talking about it, and naloxone should be offered to people. I mean, schools just started getting it here in California. It took years, and because they were concerned about who was going to administer it. And Narcan is a spray that no matter what condition you're in, it can't hurt you. That's what they say. Cannot hurt you. And but if you don't have two or three doses on you, and someone's got a bad dose of fentanyl in their system, you're not going to be able to save their life. So, and who walks around with a belt full of Narcan? I mean, I do. I have 7-8 doses in my car at all times. And when I go places that I know I'll be seeing people, I carry one or two. And I don't know why, but I feel like, you know, I put my money where my mouth is, so to speak.
Well, you're definitely doing that. Go to Scott H. Silverman on Insta and X and get his book, The Opioid Epidemic, What You Don't Know Will Destroy Your Family and Your Life, available at Amazon. And your crisiscoach.com is a great resource as well. Scott said he will be happy to talk to anybody that reaches out to him. Scott, can't thank you enough for coming back to State of the Nation. Look forward to having you on again.
Thank you so much. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. And again, people, make the phone call. Text me. We'll find a way to find a way. It's not that hard.
Give them that number. Give them that number.
619-993-2738. And I dare you. You call me this weekend, I'll give you 15 minutes of free coaching. 619-993-2738. Call me anytime. I'll turn my phone off at night just so I can sleep. But I'd be happy to help you navigate what, wherever you need to go, wherever you are in the world. Let's talk about it rather than going to funerals.
There you go, folks. That's all the resources you need right there from Scott Silverman. We've got more State of the Nation right after these words from today's News Talk, TNT.
While serving in Afghanistan, I was hit by sniper fire. The fighting was so intense, the medevac chopper was barely able to land. In the hospital, I was given a 5% chance to live. It's a good thing math wasn't my best subject. Today, I visit classrooms and share my story. I talk to kids about dealing with life's struggles. I tell them, with a little help and a lot of work, that you can overcome any challenge.
DAV helps veterans like Adam get the benefits they've earned. They help more than 1 million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
I know that some struggles are big and some are small, but they're all struggles, and you have to learn to get through them. With support from DAV, more veterans like me can live their best life. And as a new father, I have one more reason to keep on keeping on. My victory is being there for the next generation.
Adam Alexander, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
I want to eat apples and bananas. I need to eat apples and bananas. Why can't I eat apples and bananas?
Support the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks to help provide meals to those in need. Join us at feedingamerica.org.
The conversation continues with State of the Nation's Brian McLean and Timothy Shea on today's News Talk, TNT.
All right. Well, predictive programming in films has been something that Timothy and I have been indulging in a discussion a little bit about over the last week or two, because there's so much of it, and so much of it is relevant and poignant. And worth talking about. So we're going to lean into that a little bit today with our friend Bazed Lit Analyzer from the Bazed Lit Analyzer YouTube channel. Bazed, welcome back to State of the Nation. Good to see you. Happy Friday.
Hey, gentlemen. How y'all doing? Happy Friday to you.
Absolutely, man. So you've been to the cinema and you went and saw this film that Timothy and I have been wondering about. We've watched probably all four versions of the trailer multiple times, just looking at what's going on here. Cacophony of identity politics and pseudo-modern situations, reporters, Civil War is the name of the film. So tell us what you learned at the theater.
Yes, I went and saw it in the theater, and I was looking forward to the movie, and then something happened with watching some of the trailers, and I thought, is this this couldn't possibly be as bad as I am, you know, as it looks. There was just something about it that seemed off, but I decided to go see it in the cinema and pay my ticket and go watch it to see if there was any depth to it. It's Alex Garland. Alex Garland is known for, he wrote the novel The Beach, and the film of the same name. He did Ex Machina, the show Devs, Annihilation. He's done a bunch of great stuff. This one is quite different. It's not tech heavy like his sort of middle work is, but like you were mentioning, it's heavy on predictive programming, and it's bleak in a sort of complex way that I'm still trying to come to terms with because it seems so simplistic on the surface. I've watched it so that you don't have to. It's really, I wouldn't recommend going to the movie. For one thing, it contains all of the tropes that it's almost like the filmmakers were showing memes and they were unaware that there were memes or that the internet existed, which is very strange. For one, the heroes are the photojournalists. And this is a trope that we've seen with, you know, over the years. We saw it in Salvador, Oliver Stone's Salvador. We saw it in The Killing Fields. It was done very well. But now we're at a point where these things are not obsolete, but it's like we have live streamers in real time showing horrendous wartime activity all the time. And this movie is like, oh, they've got a New York Times reporter. So that lends them some credit. It's very strange. And you can't tell who the good guys and the bad guys are. I think that's purposeful, but you don't care or like any of the characters in the film. And it's clearly supposed to be a weird critique of Trump and a balkanized, you know, a civil war torn country. But it's almost like the emptiness of the landscape makes it look like the wartime stuff, the atrocities that are continuous through the movie are sort of brushed away. They're like small activities. So I'm still trying to sort of deconstruct this movie, but I'm not sure that it deserves that. Does that make sense?
It does. And one of the things I found most preposterous was that the producers claim that it's non-political. And I guess they're resting that on the fact that the Western forces are California and Texas. And I'm thinking, on what planet are California and Texas going to team up to attack Washington, D.C.?
Right. Yeah. Excellent point. I think that was purposeful because if they didn't do that, then the movie would be too real. It would be too accurate. So they have this thing that's like not even a, you know, not a possibility. And they make it make sense sort of in the film, but it's still, I guess it only makes sense in terms of what the various characters look like, their actual, you know, just surface appearance throughout the thing. And there are some things that you notice when you go to see it. I mean, all of the people committing the atrocities are they look like us. Let's say that. And it's very plain. There's a coup. The movie starts off with what's his name? Ron Swanson giving this speech where he says, we've won the victory. It was the greatest victory in the history of mankind. And it's clearly supposed to be like Trump language, but it doesn't make sense that the Western forces overthrow him. It's almost like he would be leading the Western forces in the movie. So it's sort of, there's a discontinuity somewhere in the film, and I'm not sure it was purposeful.
Right. There's like a double inverted, when we talked about it last night, I think I called it like politics out of phase. Like there's just enough phase shift among all the hot button topics to leave you with, you know, just enough cognitive dissonance and just enough confirmation bias to sit through the film and then walk out. Like, that's kind of how I felt after Leave the World Behind. I walked out of that one just going, okay, I was able to make it to the end. I definitely right. saw the parts where I was, you know, clearly supposed to experience cognitive dissonance. But one of the things you said, I kind of drew a parallel to Leave the World Behind also, the Obama-produced film, which is available on streaming services, again, about a, in this case, not so much a civil war, but perhaps an apocalypse leaning into a very similar landscape. But it, that was the whole, like, you can't make sense of who caused this. That seems to be an underlying message in a lot of these types of films is, these things happen, and sometimes when they happen, the citizens are not able to figure out why, or, you know, the who, what, when, where, and why are being obfuscated from the citizenry.
I think that's a pretty, that's an insightful take, because drawing the parallel to that other movie, because, I mean, you're absolutely right. One of the takeaways from that film is that it almost seems like it was an AI scripted film. It seems so inhuman. It's like, plastic and artificial, and I think that, you know, what you were just saying there sort of conveys that feeling that there's this chaos, this discontinuity, this sort of, we don't know where we are and we don't know how to make sense of things, so don't question them. In this movie, there's a scene that's in the trailer where there's a sniper and they say, who are you trying to get, right? And the guy's like, well, the guy's shooting at us and we're, you know, he's trying to kill us and we're trying to kill him, which is to say that the entire war boils down to that. And that is probably very truthful and accurate in actual wartime scenarios. But in the context of this movie, it just, it's like more chaos. It's, we don't know what's going on. The people are working in their shops like nothing's happened. They don't seem to be in any danger. The journalists aren't worried about live fire at all. And it's very artificial. I'm trying to get my head around why he would do this film, because Garland is he's an incredible filmmaker and writer. I really like his work. And it goes into places that, you know, Ex Machina and AI and all this stuff is, that's happened. So I suppose that this is a movie for not us. It's a movie for like the you know, like a normie at Dunkin' Donuts every morning at the same time, something, right? Somebody who is just completely unaware of everything, and they're like, oh, okay, this is how it's going to be. That's my conclusion.
You anticipated, maybe even answered my question. I was going to ask, the story arcs are for Cocta, and how is the character development? Are these flat two-dimensional characters? It sounds like they are. I don't know that, is there any character growth over the course of the movie, and how's the cinematography? Maybe this is an AI production.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, the thing I would take away from this movie and all of his work is the sound. The sound design is really stellar. It's totally immersive and it's unique. But the way that the movie is staged, I mean, one of the first scenes, they're at a protest and a woman, you know, an Ashley Babbitt runs in with a flag and then like sets off a kamikaze bomb. And it doesn't make sense. It doesn't, you're watching it and you're like, no, this isn't who does this. And yeah. The journalists, they just kind of, they've just been in an explosion, but they like get up and are taking pictures and they could hear each other talking. And from there, you're kind of like, okay, these people exist in this job that they see as like total, they feel like they're monks. Like, or saints, you know, they're above everyone. Their virtue is watching someone get tortured and not getting involved because we're journalists, right? Mm-hmm. And even though they're setting up the shot like it's a Nightcrawler or something. Mm-hmm. And the final scene in the movie really, I mean, it sort of illustrates that to a T. I mean, it's disturbing what happened. He asked him, okay, spoiler. One of the guys asked the president for his last words, and he says, I forget what he says. He says, like, don't shoot me. And he's like, okay, that's good enough. All right, go on. I thought you were objective in this. I thought you didn't play a part. Uh-huh. You know?
Yeah.
The character development is like more of like, okay, I'm gaining an ideology instead of becoming a person or showing my humanity. And I guess yeah. That's the point, you know?
Interesting. You know, it makes me wonder about the studio, A24, because I agree with you. That's a really good director, really good writer. I've seen the other ones, seen a lot of his other works, and really, you know, got a lot of enjoyment and just, you know, a lot of movies that stick with you, movies you're thinking about the next day are rare. And, you know, Ex Machina, you know, Devs, these kind of things are the sort of things that, you know, you got to think about or watch a couple times. And you can, you know, they're good. They're good stuff. But and A24 has put out like if you look at their whole, this is the production house that this is under. I've wondered about them before. You know, we've talked about Midsommar and, you know, the ramifications of that film. That was sort of when A24 started really hitting my radar. But I feel like there's maybe some sort of overarching message coming from that production studio. Do you ever feel that way?
Absolutely. I mean, A24 is still seen as the underground indie production house, which is funny because I don't know what they're worth now, but you know, they dominate Hollywood. They've become the mainstream.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And they just pump out these movies, and they are starting to have this like similar aesthetic and a similar message. And my take on the message is aesthetic terrorism, right? Mm. It's you're living life, but you should be afraid and really just feel sick when you walk out. I mean, Midsommar is the best example of that. And it's a well done film. And it's relevant, but you don't walk away ever from their movies like, you know, like glowing or feeling great about life.
Do you think this is beyond predictive programming and is an act of PSYOP intended to demoralize the population?
I think that that's very likely. I mean, it's probably a huge part of, and whether the filmmakers are even aware of that or not is sort of irrelevant in a way, because Garland has done a lot of work that deals with big data. I mean, Ex Machina was about that, right? It was big data, quantum computing, Intel agencies are built into that, PSYOPs. And I think that Hollywood is the vehicle for PSYOPs and propaganda, unlike anything the world has ever seen. So, you know, Top Gun is the best example of that, right? A fun movie about a guy.
Maverick. Hellcats of the Navy was right up there.
That's right. And it wouldn't surprise me if funding came through, you know, what do they have now instead of the Human Ecology Fund that the CIA had, whatever it is. I think that's certainly part of it.
Or Palantir. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, terrorize the population. Go see the movie. The trailer looks great, but when you come in here, you're going to walk away like, okay, confused and feeling weird because we went through this thing and it was worse like 4 years ago. And the movie sort of makes it look like that didn't even exist and this is going to happen in the future. I mean, the movie clearly is showing you that this is the thing that's going to happen. You know, right. We don't want it to, but very strange, very strange.
Yeah. I also find it somewhat interesting the way that a lot of these films, A24 films, quite frankly, don't really have a protagonist. There's sort of your sort of protagonist, sort of, I don't know what to call it other than a sort of protagonist. But in this case, it's interesting that they make, Kirsten Dunst, the journalist, the photojournalist, and you know the journalists are ostensibly the protagonists, I guess is what I'm trying to say, but they're not actually protagonists, it sounds like. And then you look at the way journalists are actually treated in the world right now. Assange, you know, he was correct, so he's in jail. Snowden, not necessarily journalist, but working with journalists, whistleblower working with journalists, he's in exile. John McAfee, sort of a journalist, maybe activist, a politician. You could put a lot of titles on John, but he's unalived.
Danny Casolaro.
Yeah. Thank you, Danny Casolaro, which if you're not familiar with, you should definitely watch The Octopus Murders and learn about Danny Casolaro. He was right, so no wonder he was assassinated, and Gonzalo Lira killed in a Ukrainian prison. So it's like, you know, we don't see any of that going on, but we, you know, that they can be the pseudo protagonist in an A24 film. Baze, we're just about out of time. Final thoughts before we got to let you go.
Yeah, go to the movies, read books, have a good weekend, love the springtime, and love each other. That's what it's about. You know, you don't have to see this movie. I've seen it for you. Thank you guys for having me. Really appreciate you. Catch me at Bayes Lit Analyzer at YouTube. Peace.
Right. Okay, thanks, Bayes. Have a great weekend, my friend. And you have a great weekend as well, Timothy. And you out there watching and listening, have a great weekend too. We'll look forward to rejoining you on Monday right here on State of the Nation. And stay tuned for the Jason Burmes Show coming up next live on today's News Talk TNT.